Today, it's, well, not quite opposite day, but day two, if there were 2 days on opposite day. Not quite.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So last time we talked about ironies that go with the sense of opposition, where the opposite of what you expect comes to pass in some context or another. And we talked about what opposites are. And by the way, I just want to mention a listener and friend, Joe Wolf, putting out a book here pretty soon called Irrational God or Rational God. I can't remember exactly the title, but you'll be able to look it up and find it. Great thinker and a math. He used mathematicians as a mathematician and a lot of logic to make these observations about God that are really interesting. So if you get a chance to look at the book, I encourage you to do so. And thanks to Joe Wolf for letting me read the chapters ahead of time. It was a lot of fun. Anyway, I say all of that because we were talking about logic a little bit and the fact that opposites are more than just opposites, that we could actually spend a lot of time talking about the nuances of what opposites are, because there are direct opposites, contradictories, as we talk about, and then there are contraries and subalterns and subcontraries, and there's all kinds of opposition out there. And so we spent the last time talking about how, in reality, opposites most often are things that are almost identical and then differ in exactly one quality, like negative 5 being the opposite of 5 in, you know, some considerations. So the point is that I'm not just talking about opposites. I'm trying to talk about the nuanced reality that we have to deal with in order to interact with the world as it actually is. And the way we like to do that is to treat it like it can be easily bifurcated. There's that half over there, and ne'er shall it touch this half over here. And think of it, and what how people say this very often is in black and white terms. But that's, you know, that's highly misleading, because sometimes black and white are loaded terms in themselves, and sometimes what we mean by that or what a person is saying with that is that there is no nuance whatsoever and that there are no gray areas. But even gray implies for most people a sort of moral capitulation. Oh, we can compromise on anything. So we start to miss the whole conversation. So my point is to emphasize that even things we think of as being as far apart as they could possibly be are actually a lot closer together than we would like to think or than we normally think. And the fact that we put them in the same category and say, look how different those two things are, tells you how similar they are in our minds. Why did we think we needed to point out that they were different? Because they have all of these other characteristics that make us think they should be the same. Anyway, I'm getting too wound up and haven't even gotten to the topic yet. So to get back to the topic, we went through a few examples of how things that we think of as the same have this ironic tension in them, or things that we think of as being opposites, I mean, have this ironic tension in them, so that they're surprisingly similar. And I used altruism and spite as the most significant example. We also talked about crying and laughing and gave a historical example of that, but ended up in a place where I was saying, in reality, that for us to see, because of spite and altruism, for us to see how close together all these things can be would also require us to have some kind of just basically supernatural intervention in the world to change the way we think about everything. And I didn't explain why that is. We didn't get to the point of really covering why that is and why it's important. And that's what we'll do today. That's the goal, to think about how important it is to have a radical eruption, that's with an I, into the environment, into the world, to avoid the inevitable collapse of our interest into what would normally just be selfishness, or at one level or another, for us just to be selfish. And I haven't explained how we would get there yet. Obviously, I introduced the concept of altruism, and I mentioned the book about George Price and his history, The Price of Altruism, in which I found a lot of this sort of stimulating conversation that provoked a lot of the ideas that I'm talking about now. Some of these ideas are directly related to that. Some are very indirectly related to it, but they all do lead to this conclusion that we need to be aware of how important it is that we accept this supernatural disruption of our way of living in the world. So I want to get there with one more example of a contradictory that we would think of as not being compatible at all, and that we do think of that way, but which in reality, and I'll give two different versions of the contradictories, which in reality are they have a lot more common ground than we would like to acknowledge. And we'll do it with public policy, with economics, with the way people think about politics a lot right now. In terms of, let's say, a socialist approach to economics and politics, as opposed to what I'm going to refer to as a libertarian approach to politics and economics. I could say conservative and progressive. We could use a lot of different terms, and they're all adequate in some ways. But I think a socialist gets across the idea there are some people who think of this as a more communal, society-wide obligation that we have, and we should be thinking in terms of our common shared basis in the society, and hence socialist. And then the libertarian side that is all about liberty. It is the individual that matters above and beyond everything else, and you maintain the society solely so you have a context within which individual liberties can be maximally realized. So those two are about as opposite an ideology as you can imagine in terms of what I want to discuss. So let's take it from the perspective of someone who would be a libertarian, and which, again, I mean, I'm just full disclosure, that's more my inclination. I'm naturally and throughout my life inclined toward libertarian views, towards a real focus on individualism. And, you know, over the decades, I've become more aware of how important the communal elements are, but it's still my default position to advocate for personal liberties. I can't break that priority. It's just built into me. So with that said, and I'm not sure I want to, by the way, with that said, the first of these is much easier for me to say. So it's the thing that we would refer to as the socialist contradiction. So as a libertarian, from a libertarian perspective, a libertarian could say that socialists say this. And what I'm going to try to do, so I just want you to be able to hang with me through this little part of the conversation, and then we're going to replicate it on the inverted side. So on this side of the conversation, I just want to show you how a libertarian would look at the socialist argument and say, well, that's self-contradictory. Those people are just they're talking out of both sides of their mouth, and they're not recognizing that they're contradicting themselves. So here's the socialist contradiction from a libertarian perspective. It's not the only criticism that could be made. Not every libertarian would agree with it. I'm a libertarian, so I can say this is a libertarian's perspective on a socialist contradiction, because it's one that I've held in the past. And yeah, I don't think it's completely inaccurate in the present. It maybe not nuanced completely, but it's there. Okay, I know. Move on. Here we are. So a libertarian could say this. Well, look, the socialists say money in the hands of the successful, and I'm exaggerating it. This is hyperbole. Money in the hands of the successful is a sign of their selfishness. So that's, you know, they're rich because they're greedy and they're evil. That's what a socialist could say from a libertarian perspective. That's what the socialists say. If I were being more generous about it, if I were libertarian and I wasn't just trying to use inflammatory rhetoric, then I could say, look, I'm not even against a person making a bunch of money and having success and being wealthy. But if they have too much money, I mean, come on. If you have so much money that you can't even figure out how to spend it, and people are lying at your doorstep starving to death, you know, you should probably do something different with the money that you have. That would be a socialist argument from a libertarian perspective if we were being considerate about it, right? If we were being thoughtful about it. But the challenge is that when we say this and we say, oh, yeah, well, if they have too much money, they should get rid of it, Part of the challenge, by the way, this is just side note, parenthetically, you know, how much is too much? Is it okay to have a million? Is it okay to have 2 million? Is it okay to have enough that you could live for a year without working? Or is a year too long? Should you only be able to work for, you know, go without work for 6 months? And then, or should you have nothing? You know, I mean, work every day. You shouldn't rest on your laurels but from the past and so on. I mean, how do you determine what's too much? Is a billion too much? And so on. A billion seems like plenty, by the way. So I'm just saying, I'm not saying it seems like too much to go beyond that. I understand how money works. But I am saying it's a very difficult question. So here's the challenge. If I'm a libertarian and I want to criticize the socialist who says those rich people have too much money, and I really just want to say it that way, then I would say, well, then why does the socialist want the poor to have that same money? I mean, I thought the priority here was to give up personal possessions and the whole idea of just desiring to have money so that you can have, you know, everything that you want to need and spend on. So in other words, a libertarian could make the critique of a socialist. And as I said, this is not as finely nuanced as it probably could be. I mean, I know it's not because it's just, but I have heard it. And I've heard it this way, and I've heard it even less nuanced than this in the mouths of real people. Not that I'm not a real person, but you know what I mean. Believe it or not, this is not AI. You're like, oh, we could tell that. I mean, it could be A, but not I, that's for sure. So anyway, the point is here, come on, give me a break. We're back to this. The point is that if you put it in a single statement, it is a libertarian saying, socialist justice seems to say these people are wrong for keeping or using what these people feel cheated, these other people feel cheated by not being able to keep or use for themselves. Well, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you give people money, they have it. And if you don't give it to them, and I mean whether they earn it or not, I'm not talking about that. If you don't give it to them, they don't have it. Everybody gets money from somebody else. So if somebody has money and you say, oh, they shouldn't have money because other people don't have it, what's the solution to that? Nobody has money, or you redistribute the money, in which case, well, then everybody's got the money and you're like, oh, yeah, but they all have the same amount. Really? Is that what we really think is going to happen? And do people all want the same amount of things? So it just seems like there's a contradiction in saying we don't want people to be focused on money, but we want to be able to focus on money and giving it to different people than the ones who have it, who focused on it in order to get it, by the way. But we want to be able to take it from them to give it to the people who didn't focus on it because it's not important to them or important to us, but it's important to us to get it to them. That seems, you can see why a person might think there's a contradiction in there, right? I'm not saying there is. I'm not saying it's a satisfactory argument. It's not. But I hear it. I hear arguments very similar to that all the time. And the to be fair to the socialists here, and I'm not one, but to be fair to the socialists, their actual claim is different. It's not whether or even how much money people have. A societal agreement is what people have about what should amount to the least amount of wealth or money or provision or whatever our society of shared wealth should tolerate a person being able to have or being deprived from having. So another way of saying that is a person who's accused by others of being a socialist in our society would actually say something more like, what's the maximum amount of suffering or the minimal standard of living that we're willing to tolerate as a society? And let's just make sure nobody falls below that. And when people are at a certain level in their wealth, then we will use some of their wealth to keep people from falling below those cracks. I'm not arguing for that to happen. I'm saying if a socialist heard this critique of the self-contradictory nature of saying, you shouldn't care about money, we want to take your money and give it to somebody else because we don't care about it except for the fact that we want to take it and give it to somebody else, that when a socialist heard that contradictory accusation, that accusation of being self-contradictory, that they would respond by saying, well, that's not what we want. We just want a minimum standard of discomfort that we're willing to say we're not going to let anyone fall below in our society. And then a recognition that above a certain amount of wealth, people have enough comfort that they could give up a little bit to keep other people from falling through the cracks entirely. And that question does entail harvesting money from somewhere and making sure it gets elsewhere. In some way, that has to happen for the socialist cause, and again, I'm just labeling it generically, not technically here, to to be followed at all. Something like that has to happen. And so, you know, you can understand why a libertarian would criticize that. Okay, so let's talk about how a socialist might talk about a libertarian. And I can talk about this freely because I've had these accusations made against me readily throughout most of my life. So the libertarian contradiction, speaking from a socialist perspective, and really, this is not technically a contradiction, but more of an ethical absurdity or a moral inconsistency. From the socialist or really more the progressives kind of perspective, anybody who's not just straight up libertarian in their thinking, they would say, well, what the conservatives or the libertarians say is the best way to help the poor, and we have said this for a long time, the best way to help the poor and the weak is by helping the rich and the powerful. Now, you can hear the irony built into that statement. Well, the best way to help the poor and the weak is to help the rich and the powerful. A libertarian hears that statement and they're like, yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And by the way, that so y'all understand why that would happen. I'll explain it more in just a moment if you don't. Part of what that would entail, saying, well, what we want to do is help the rich and powerful, and we know, hue and cry, I thought you were supposed to help the poor. We believe this will help the poor. I'm not saying I actually advocate for or against this right now. This would just be the case that a progressive could make about the inherent inconsistencies in some of libertarians' arguments. So the best way to help the poor and weak is by helping the rich and powerful. How do you do that? Well, part of it would be removing the obstacles to their success. So regulations, other forms of government interference, high tax rates, all those things need to go away. Well, it's not hard to figure out how that contradicts the socialist objective, right? So we're not redistributing as much money as we were before, at least not through the forms of government that were in place. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that the regulations are generally intended to protect all the people who aren't rich and powerful. I mean, that's what they're there for, including the poor. And so the result, and this is sort of inherently true, and I think most libertarians would acknowledge this, the result of a laissez-faire environment for business can be a pretty brutal environment for people who are living toward the bottom rung in society. So you can understand the claim that would go against the libertarian sort of approach to solving this problem. But just to be fair, by the way, the criticism of the progressives is not really just about making that critique. It's about saying, look, these regulations and things are not about punishing business. They're about advocating for the disenfranchised. So we're not trying to fight against the rich and the powerful. We're just trying to recognize that the people who aren't rich and powerful are also a part of society and need to be protected. You can hear that. What's interesting in all of this, and obviously, you know, because I'm a libertarian, you sort of got the sense of how the trickle-down economic model works to begin with. I'll mention it again in a moment. But what I want you to recognize in the difference between those two critiques, the socialist's critique of a libertarian inherent inconsistency and the libertarian's critique of the socialist contradiction about the value or unimportance of money, what they have in common is actually a lot more than I think most people who claim one side or the other of those arguments admits. They both believe, and this is absolutely the case, I've talked to people on both sides, they both believe that their approach is the best way to promote the most good for the most people in society. They think this is going to promote the welfare of the individuals and the groups that are within our society. Both argue that their approach raises the standard of living for the poor. Libertarians make their argument through trickle-down prosperity. You know, we will have wealth at the top, and that'll provide more resources for those below to take advantage of, and more open doors with fewer regulations for people to become competitors, and blah, blah, blah. And progressives argue that it'll help raise the standard of living for the poor through direct redistribution. I mean, they will have more money at the end of the month. They won't be trying to find food. They'll be able to go out and make a living, do something for the benefit of society overall or whatever. And they both argue that their approach distributes justice, not just money, not just raises the standard of living for the poor. They both argue that their approach has this moral underpinning to it, that it distributes justice more universally and more effectively than the other approach. Libertarians, by reducing the amount of government intrusion on individuals, obviously. So if government's not in your house, you know, it's the famous Ronald Reagan ironic line, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. The 10 words he said, all of us fear, you know, more than anything else. I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. I'm not even sure it's 10 words, but I think that's what he says in the quote. That you know, that's the libertarian line. The government is the problem. They are imposing, they're infringing on our freedom. So let's limit that. And the progressive argument is that somebody is intruding on your liberties, but it's not mainly the government. It's mainly the corporate abuses that are happening that are bringing these harms to you. And somebody's got to rein in those corporate abuses. And to be fair to their argument, if we look back at the 19th century, the century of industrialization, it's not hard to say that, you know, the greatest threat to the poor in that time was the industrial complex that existed at the moment, not the military industrial complex. That's Eisenhower and afterwards. We'll talk about that another day. So anyway, you get what I'm talking about here, dealing with the importance of recognizing that opposites are not as opposite as we think. They share a lot of common ground. And if you sit down and say, if you're a libertarian and you sit down with someone who just claims to be an out-and-out socialist, let's say. So let's say we could get Rand Paul to sit down and have a conversation with AOC. I'm sorry, I don't even know her full name out. I should, but I don't know it off the top of my head. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. There you go. I got it pulled out. Let's say we could get them to sit down and actually talk to each other like human beings. I don't know that that's possible. Let's pretend for a moment that it were possible. They could actually begin by saying, so what's your goal? Well, look, my goal is to advocate for the people who are being excluded from a lot of the basic benefits of living in this society. I want them to be provided for better. And then if they could both acknowledge that they actually both do want to do that, and I think they do, I don't know how sincere they are as human beings. I don't know them personally, but I mean their public personas at least claim that they want to do that. And if that's the case, then you could have an actual conversation about it. So I had mentioned to you before that the longer I lived, this is how we ended the last episode, by the way, that the longer I lived, the more I realized how intertwined all of these arguments are, how close together all of these oppositions are. And so it becomes less and less beneficial in my mind just to have a diatribe or something else, and instead recognize that there actually is a value in having a, and when I say a conversation, I don't mean a salesman's conversation. I'm not being insulting to salesmen, but I mean, as a salesman, you're just on a path to get to a sale. You that's your job. Get to the sale. Get the name on the dotted line with the contract. That's not what I mean by let's have a conversation and let me somehow wheedle you into agreeing with me when you didn't even realize you were changing your mind. I don't mean that. I mean literally listen to the other person and maybe even, I can't imagine it being the case, but learn something while we're doing it. It's mind-boggling how many things have clicked in my mind and made me say to myself, how could you not have seen that before? Because I just listened to someone. And it took me decades to get there. So believe me, I'm not patting myself on the back. If anything, I'm self-flagellating in the moment. Why on earth did it take me so long to start listening to people? And I barely listen now. I can't even hear what you guys are saying. So anyway, the point is, it's not just that, but to have a conversation. So that's where we ended the talk last time. So what I want to do is go back to why I was saying that supernatural intervention that I mentioned right at the beginning of today's episode, why that's so important, why it's so critical to what we're doing. And it inevitably brings me back to the talk that we were having about altruism when we were talking about altruism and spite. And the reason that it does is because, and this is true in every kind of theory, in evolutionary theory, in everything that would deal with the realm of human interactions. So evolutionary theory, sociology, politics, my personal years of experience and observation, I'm sure for counselors, you know, Daisy, who produces the show, is a licensed professional counselor. I'm sure she would see it as time goes by and she deals with more and more clients. I just, you know, it's inherent to how human beings relate to each other and interact. And it is an inevitable contest regarding altruism. And I do mean contest. There is a cost for being altruistic, which sounds odd because the cost of being selfish is that you can't be altruistic. So you give up some selfishness and become altruistic, and you would think the cost of altruism is just selfishness. That's what you give up. You have to lose some selfishness, and you do. But the problem is that selfishness exists in layers in our minds, in our way of existing as human beings. It's not, I'm not just selfish in one way, in a singular way. And so the progression that happens, and I think this is so interwoven into Christianity. It's so woven into the Old and New Testament. But, you know, I'm approaching it as a Christian and approaching it as a follower of Christ. And because of that, even for people who know me or have known me for a long time and wouldn't agree with me about my Christianity, I hope would at least know and acknowledge that my Christianity is what's shaping even the things I critique about the other Christians that I know. It's the things that I think the Old and New Testament just require of us. And they require it of us in such a plain fashion. And it's so consonant with what I'm talking about here regarding altruism that I want to put it in that context and sort of weave it together for you as we come to a close on both of these episodes now. So the inevitable cost, or I mean contest, that's what I was saying a moment ago, but it is a cost of altruism, does have to do with selfishness, but at a higher level. So let's just take it one step at a time. So selfish people, that's just where we start. And I'm using the negative word for it. I could just say egoistic people, because it doesn't have to be evil selfishness. It's just people who are concerned about themselves. And that's what you are when you're hungry. You're concerned about yourself. You're being what I mean in this context by selfish. I don't mean three-year-old temper tantrum selfish. That's normally the freight that we put into the word. So just hang with me on the word selfish in this context, meaning you're inherently concerned with the things about yourself. I mean, you know, if you don't start out that way, who else is going to be that way, right? That's what we would all say. So selfish people become more altruistic. Altruistic meaning you care about others, and you care about them because of them, not because of what it gives you, what it provides for you. That would be selfish again. So we talked about that conundrum last time. We don't have to rehash that. Selfish people become more altruistic as they identify. Now, this is just empirically true. In other words, making observations and with experience, we've learned this is how it happens. People don't happen to wake up and become altruistic. We are altruistic as we identify with the people that we used to neglect. This is why altruism and empathy are so inherently related. If you're not empathetic, your altruism probably doesn't exist at all. Empathy, meaning you actually identify with that person's suffering. You identify with whatever that other person is experiencing. So selfish people become more altruistic. This is not quite tautological, but it's awfully close to it. Selfish people become more altruistic as they identify with the people that they used to neglect, as they develop empathy, therefore, for the people that they used to neglect. And this makes sense. That's the basis for the command that we love our neighbors as ourselves. How many times and how many episodes that are brought up Leviticus 19? The answer to that question is not enough. There is not enough. We could never talk about it enough. It's the great commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. And if you, I know there are two. I know how they go together. I know how they fit together. We're not doing that. Not going down that road. Stop interrupting. Okay, so here's the point. The basis for the command that we love our neighbors as ourselves is that we already love ourselves. That's what's built into the command. If that weren't true about us, the rest of the command would make no sense. Love your neighbor as yourselves. Oh, well, I hate myself, so I can hate my neighbor, and I'm doing just fine. See, Lord, I'm okay. That's ridiculous. Even for people who do loathe themselves in some way, you already love yourselves in more ways. So, and the reason I say it's the basis for the command in, you know, such confidence is because of how even Paul, and I'll use Paul several times today, talks about it in Ephesians 5 when he's talking about the husbands and the wives. This line always almost makes me laugh. It doesn't make me laugh, but it almost does, because it's just so plain, stinking true, and usually not said. And it's, you know, when he's telling husbands, love their wives, you know, you need to love your wife as if she's your own flesh, because, and he's obviously extrapolating from the statement, love your neighbor as yourself, love your wife as if she's your own flesh, love her as your own flesh. Why are you able to say that? For no one, quoting him in chapter 5, verse 29 of Ephesians, for no one ever hated his own flesh, Paul says, but nourishes and cherishes it. His point is that you automatically care for yourself. His point isn't, oh, we're all solipsists. We think we're the only people who exist in the world. Or, oh, look how Epicurean in the modern sense we all are. We just, you know, it's all about personal pleasure. We're all hedonistic. No, you know, that's not his point. His point is it's automatic for you to care about yourself. You know how to care about yourself. The question is, can you care about the one flesh you've united the way you care about yourself? And that would be identifying with them as one flesh. So the basis of the command to love your neighbors as your neighbor as yourself is to recognize that you do love yourself. You know how to care about yourself. And what you need to do is identify with someone else closely enough that caring for them is as natural as it is to care for you. That's what the basis of the command is. So as selfish people, we take a step out of that and finally become altruistic. But then in altruism, that means you've developed a social care. You care about others. Oh, I feel responsible for other people. I give myself to my community. I whatever. So you become an altruist. Okay. The social care, which is a form of altruism, the social care that we bestow on others, that's not me, that's them, but I identify with them, and so I care about them, and so I'm expressing this empathy, and I have this altruistic response to their needs. The social care that we bestow on those others, when we include them as we, that's part of us. They're part of the we that we use. So now the social care that we bestow on others, as long as we're willing to include them as part of we, inevitably results in the exclusion of others that we're able to exclude as they. They're not part of the we. We don't mean to do it, but it's built into having a we. You know, am I one of you? Oh, yeah. Well, what does that mean? It means we have this unique bond of sharing social obligations and concern and empathy that we don't have with those, with the they that's out there. And so partially, you know, this is just human nature. It's just the way we are. And it probably is, based on all the observations people make in biology, not just human nature. It's just the nature of being a thing. Partially, the sense of belonging entails both sides. It entails both an identification with those to whom we do belong and a distinction from those to whom we don't belong. If you can't demarcate the two, you don't have any sense of belonging. That's how we are as human beings. And you can hear the problem that comes with that. That's why and I've talked about this 100 times and in several episodes, it's why the strangers passages in the Old Testament, the outsiders, the sojourners, the Gentiles, it's why those strangers passages in the Old Testament become so prominent and so important. The stronger Israel's identification as the people of God becomes, the stronger also becomes their exclusion of whoever's not one of them. And why wouldn't it? Look, these people don't follow the law of God. These people had to be kicked out of the land because of the disturbance they brought to it. These people don't know Yahweh. That's true. All of those things were true. So obviously their identification with each other as the people of God made their exclusion of the others only stronger. And that, which is human nature, which was perfectly understandable. We have a temple. We have priests who can go into it, and some of us can't. And we have men who can and women who can't. And we have all these groups that we've created. Inherently, we're going to start thinking, ooh, some people are just excluded from the group. That is so automatically present in us that, again, reading the Old Testament, it's right there in all of the books. It's constantly pushed back against by the prophets. It's not like any of this surprises God. So if you read about Jonah going to Nineveh and talking to the Assyrians, it's not about the Assyrians and the Ninevites learning a lesson. It's about Israel learning a lesson, that God wants them to repent and to extend his grace to them in exactly the same way he wants to extend it to Israel. And that's part of his extending grace to Israel, is for them to learn that. If you read the book of Amos, you go from the transgressions of all of them, all of those people, Damascus and Gaza and Tyre and Edom and Ammon and Moab and Judah. Wait, that's us. How could we be included among them? It's a major theme in the prophets. It's not a minor issue, which is why when you get into the New Testament, the mystery of Christ himself is so specific in Ephesians 3. Paul says it this way in Ephesians 3, starting in verse 4. When you read this, Paul says, you can perceive my insight into the mystery of Christ. Not a mystery, the mystery of Christ, which was not made known to the sons of men in other generations, as it has been now revealed to his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit. Well, what's the mystery, Paul? This mystery, he says in verse 6, is that the Gentiles are fellow heirs, members of the same body, and partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel. It's not a minor issue in the New or Old Testament that the people we thought were other, were they, are actually us. And it's not a mystery then that what God is teaching us in telling us that they're included is that our empathy, our altruism, our care, our love is supposed to extend as far as his sovereignty and grace extend. And that's over the whole face of the earth. So what I'm saying is this: while our nature, you know, as individuals, as families, as neighborhoods, then as communities, these are all the layers. They're all the layers of our selfishness. As individuals, as families, as neighborhoods, as communities, as regions, now we think of them as states, as nations. If our nature in every one of those iterations is to see ourselves as part of a specific group and care for that group by protecting ourselves or our group from those who are threatening and dangerous outsiders, and sometimes they really are threatening and dangerous. That's just part of the reality. Then we realize that God's intrusion into our world with his grace is his way of, you know, undermining our sense of belonging to one group instead of another, and replacing that with, instead of getting us to find our belonging in him, and therefore with everyone created in his image. I mean, when Paul is speaking outside the Antonian fortress on the Temple Mount, you know, when they've had a riot, they're trying to kill him. The reason they're wanting to kill him is because he has said all kinds of things to them before he gets to this. I've mentioned this before. He has said that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah. He has talked about following Jesus, Jesus speaking to him on the road. He's given the story of his conversion. He's talked about his entire testimony, and none of it bothers them until he says, God sent me to the Gentiles. Then they want to kill him. To the who? That's they. We don't care about them. We're going to kill you. And get the picture. This is Lot being killed by the Sodomites. It's the same thing. The whole point is that Paul can't be a part of their society, our inside group, if you won't identify yourself with us instead of that outside group. You have to pick Paul, and he won't. It's why when he's on Mars Hill, long before that, why when he's on Mars Hill in Acts 17, he gives this message to the people in Athens. He's describing God, and he says, since he himself, and he's describing this to pagans. They're absolutely lost. There are only two or three or four of them who are even going to talk to him about the resurrection when he's done with this message. He says to all of these people who are worshiping false gods, since God himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's not actually far from any one of us, for in him we, he says to a group of people worshiping pagan gods, We live and move and have our being, even as one of your own poets said, we are indeed his offspring. And Paul says to all these people worshiping false gods, being then God's offspring. And then he begins to tell them about Christ. So that's why I, as I mentioned last time, that's why we have to go from judgments and exclusions and diatribes to conversations with people we've come to realize are just another other to care about, another other to serve, another other to love, just like Jesus loved us.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.